Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business is approval of the February 23rd minutes. Representative Woodard moves approval of those minutes. Any discussions, corrections, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The next item on our agenda here is a hearing regarding the compensatory and integration funding formulas. We're going to start off today. The first presenter is going to be our nonpartisan staff of Tim Strom and Greg Crow. Do you guys want to present from here, or do you want to be up at the front table?
Mr. Chair, we're fine from here.
Are you fine from here? Okay. So go ahead and proceed with your testimony, and we'll periodically interrupt with questions from members.
Mr. Chair, would you prefer us to start with integration revenue or compensatory revenue?
My preference would be that you begin with integration.
Okay.
And we'll go from there, but I'm flexible on that, Mr. Okay. Strom.
Mr. Chair and members, there's two documents in your packet today regarding integration and desegregation revenue. You'll also hear in a bit from the State Legislative Auditor's Office about a report they did a few years ago regarding integration revenue. The two documents I'm going to be referring to are a five-page or a four-page handout that says school desegregation and integration. It's a Word document, and it's got some state-level summary data on it. And then the second document we'll be using is the integration revenue printout for fiscal year 2011. This is on the 8.5 by 11 page. And says estimated integration revenue fiscal year 2011. So those are the two documents that we'll be using for our discussion of desegregation revenue. Mr. Crow and I will go through those, and then we'll go to compensatory revenue after that. Mr. Chair, members, a couple of things to point out to you about integration revenue that are perhaps helpful for you. Prior to the 2000 legislative session, school districts, only three districts in the state, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, had filed integration revenue plans. There was a former state board rule that the school districts were under. That rule had been replaced in the late 1990s. But there was funding prior to that time, and that funding was a mix of aid and levy. And if you go to the chart if you go to the chart on page 2, which is labeled Table 2, you can see that as far back as 1987, the fiscal year 1988 and payable year 1987, there was a mix of aid and levy for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth for integration revenue programs. So the state categorical funding for these programs essentially started in fiscal year 1988. And as you look up from the bottom of that chart all the way up to fiscal year 2001, it was just those three school districts that were subject to the program. The aid amounts came through an annual appropriation in the K-12 bill. There wasn't a statutory formula at that time. And there was also levy authority that was granted, and you can see that authority was granted in different years to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. And that revenue, the sum of the aid and the levy, was for the integration programs that were run by those three districts. It included funding for programmatic activities, and it also included a transportation component for pupil transportation. So you can see that those dollar amounts, as you look up the chart there for each of those three, increased over that time period from 1988 to about 2000 when we went to the statewide formula. And then you can see that since that time, the relative dollar amounts have been roughly the same in recent years. And so now if you turn back to the first page, you can see the current formula amounts for each of the school districts in the state. Districts that are eligible for integration revenue are those with plans that are on file with the Department of Education, and the amount of revenue that a district's eligible to is determined by statute. It's either the lesser of the district's actual costs or the statutory formula amounts. And those formula amounts are $480 for Minneapolis, $445 for St. Paul School District, $206 per pupil for the Duluth School District, and then for all other participating school districts in the state, if the district's number of children who are students of color is greater than 15%, they receive $129 per pupil. And otherwise, if they're a participating district, they receive $92 per pupil. And you can see on this chart on the first page here, these dollar amounts have really been relatively unchanged for the last decade. So then if you turn to the printout that's labeled Estimated Integration Revenue, and that's the printout that's oriented landscape on the letter size page here, you can see the funding that's currently available for each district. There's some small things that may change before this is final data. This is the school year we're in. And this printout groups at the top the number of pupils, and for integration revenue we use the adjusted weighted average daily membership count of pupils. And you can see statewide that 24.8% of the students in the state of Minnesota are currently students of color, 945,000 weighted pupils in the state, and the current law estimate for total integration revenue is $94.8 million statewide. The statute simply divides the revenue 70% in state aid and 30% levy. So as you look to the next set of four columns, the integration levy is $28.4 million statewide, and the integration aid is $66.3 million statewide. Then those same totals are broken out for the metro area and the non-metro area, and then broken into some more defined groups with suburban metro without the cities of the first class, the two cities of the first class, regional centers in greater Minnesota, and then all other non-metro school districts. And you can see how those percentages vary. And then as you look through the printout, it's simply in school district order. Remember on our printout, school districts are grouped by county in alphabetical order of the counties. So as you go through that district, if you're looking for your districts, think of your county number and alphabetize that, and that'll put you about where those school district numbers are. So as you look up and down that printout, you can see their current amount of integration revenue, their current percentage students of color, and then the split between aid and levy. So, Mr. Chair, maybe now would be a good time for questions on the integration revenue program.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And we would open it up for any questions at this time. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crow, on are charter schools not eligible then for integration levy? So you have to have a levy before you can actually take integration state aid, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, the charter schools were eligible for 2 years for integration revenue for a separate formula, and then that formula was eliminated. And since that time, they are not eligible for funding. It's not just an aid levy issue. It was a policy decision the legislature made about charter schools. So there was a separate integration formula for charter schools, but that was eliminated. I don't remember the year, but it was only in existence for 2 years. So charter schools, they show up on this printout with their percentages, but they're not eligible for integration revenue.
Representative Water.
Follow up, and I don't mean to hold you to policy decisions, Mr. Crow, but do you know what the reasoning behind taking the charter schools off of the integration?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, that's a very good question, and some of the members that were here at the time may want to comment on that as well. Part of the issue was a number of the early charter schools were specifically attended by groups with very similar interests. So we had charter schools, for example, that were 95% Hispanic, or charter schools that were 98% Black. And there was some question about whether if a charter school set at its mission that it was going to be an Afrocentric academy, would this be consistent with any kind of definition of integration? Maybe rationale for lots of other things, including perhaps achievement gap issues, but from a point of view of mixing students, that it makes sense to have an integration formula if a school could have as its mission essentially something like an Afrocentric mission. So I think that was part of what drove that discussion. And as I say, if some of the members that were here at the time remember, they may want to speak up. One thing that the legislative auditor's staff will speak to when they get here is that the requirements for our integration revenue program reflect the the lack of direction that the legislature has provided to districts. There are a whole number of different uses for integrated revenue. Some of those are very much related to mixing students. Others of those are more oriented towards things like the achievement gap and student performance. And these issues have been very controversial since the legislative auditor's report came out. The House, I can't speak for the Senate, I know in the House education committees they've had some substantial discussions and arguments about how that program should be structured. The end result has been relatively little change, still a long list of programs that are eligible for integration revenue uses, but there's been a lot of discussion about whether that list should be narrowed and whether the program should be more directly focused. Also, there's been a fair amount of discussion about the role of intra-district versus inter-district activities.
Thank you, Mr. Strong. Mr. Representative Woodard?
Mr. Chair, I have an hour's worth of questions if you would entertain that. I assume you won't, so I'll just limit it to one more question then. So is it safe to say, Mr. Crow, that this is just sort of a pot of money on this particular categorical that says we understand that these school districts have unique challenges when it comes to integration, and we allow them then to say, here's how I intend to address achievement gap, as an example?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, yes, the list is quite lengthy in statute of the programs that qualify, and the districts then submit their plans to the Department of Education, and the Department of Education does make a review of whether or not the conditions that are outlined in that plan are sufficient. But there are a whole number of different options. So some districts, for example, their only integration activities may be inter-district activities. They may involve cooperating with a neighboring school district, and that may be the extent of their activities as designed by that integration group or that integration district. Another district may have a whole series of things they do. They may do inter-district activities. They may do magnet schools within the district, mixed children within the district. They may have other programs within the district that are designed for other issues. Let's see here. I don't have the list of all of those activities in the handout here, but that's in the statute, and I'll if you don't mind, I'll grab that and read off that list of what those programs are. Mr. Crow will read off what those activities are, but they're a very loose and very large, gives districts very large freedom as to how they design their programs.
And Mr. Chair, since they're looking that up, can I ask one more question?
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Crow, then, on give me a brief explanation then of what the difference between a magnet school and a charter school is, since magnet schools are really funded out of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, in some school districts, a magnet school it can have different meanings, but for purposes of in general of how Minneapolis or of how Minnesota has done it, a magnet school is usually referring to a school that may have attendance areas. It's a district-operated school that may have an attendance area different than a geographic attendance area. So, for example, in the city of St. Paul, a magnet school may have any number of different focuses. It could be an immersion language school, or it could be an environmental studies program. And the reason for its magnet school designation is usually because it has an attendance area that's district-wide, as opposed or area-wide, as opposed to a neighborhood school where your attendance would be controlled by the boundaries set by that district. So the magnet school may have a mission that's on a particular focus, but in general, in Minnesota, the magnet schools are operated by the districts as just another program. The staff at that magnet school is on the same contract as the other teachers. There may be a different distribution of resources there. One other thing I should add is that in the 80s, when the magnet school concept was used in both St. Paul and Minneapolis, the two schools chose very different approaches toward magnet schools. And in St. Paul, St. Paul chose subject matter and style choices like a language immersion, environmental immersion, a gifted and talented program, where those were the magnets. In Minneapolis, when the magnet schools were first created, they were actually based on styles of learning. So the Minneapolis School District, for example, had sort of a back-to-basic style of program and an open style of program, and their magnets really reflected a teaching style as opposed to a particular subject area concentration. But that approach did not work very well for the district, and by the early 90s, they had basically gone to the same model as St. Paul, where a magnet school is essentially a school that has different attendance area designations and may have a particular focus.
Okay. Representative Woodard.
Mr. Chair, since Mr. Strom, I assume you're still looking, so please grant me that. You're still looking. So, Mr. Crow, but with open enrollment, when it comes to charter schools then, so doesn't that kind of take away the need for the geographics?
Mr. Chair, so Representative Woodard, with open enrollment, essentially a student has the opportunity to attend another school district if they can be, if that school district accepts them. There's some very minimal levels of acceptance that are required of districts in terms of the number of students they take. There's no guarantee under open enrollment that you get into a particular program. So for example, if a Minneapolis student wants to open enroll into Hopkins School District, the Minneapolis student has the right to use the open enrollment process, and if Hopkins is allowing students to come under open enrollment, they'll take that student. But the Minneapolis student can't say, I want to be at elementary school A. That's up to the school board of the accepting school district which school they'll be at. The charter schools are independently operated from the school districts in Minnesota. They've got their own board of directors. They don't have a geographic boundary. They can choose essentially what focus they have, and some of them have chosen a focus like a magnet focus, an area of study or a particular theme like an environmental center, for example. But I'd say the big difference is that the magnet schools are essentially a district-owned and operated facility, and it's generally speaking a program that's either designed for a particular purpose or a designed for a way to blend attendance areas. And in St. Paul, for example, when their first school, the first gifted and talented magnet, I think, which was their first one, was created, part of the thinking behind that was if they put that at a location where they weren't getting many white kids to go to school, they'd be able to integrate that school by bringing white children into a neighborhood where they otherwise wouldn't be.
Representative Woodard.
I would also like to point out that I think we're being pranked because Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom have switched their name tags, and I don't know that that's...
Mr. Chair, they're always switched. Mr. Crow and I are totally interchangeable, so we don't mind. In terms of the integration revenue process, the list of uses essentially is pretty long. It was shortened a bit in 2009, but essentially it covers anything that includes increased or sustained interracial contacts, improved educational outcomes and opportunities, designed to close the achievement gap, staff initiatives, and of course a category called other educationally related programs. So it's still a very, very broad statute in terms of how a school district can use that money. They have to have their plan approved by the department, but for example, if the group of districts that Anoka works with on integration matters says ours is mainly about magnet schools where we're going to switch kids for the year, and another integration group says ours is about once every other week having students from these schools get together and do activities, those styles of plans could both be approved by the Department of Education, and the department is given broad authority to approve those plans.
Thank you,
Representative
Mr. Chair.
Woodard.
Mr. Strom. Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stroll. I noticed going through the percents of students of color, like, for example, Hopkins has 33.5% students of color, and Deer River has 33.6% students of color. Hopkins gets integration revenue, and Deer River does not get integration revenue. Can you tell us, you know, why a district chooses to apply or not apply? I mean, I don't know that you've addressed that yet. And in looking, I mean, there's a fair amount of, you know, percents of student of color based on different districts that applies to. Can you address that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Ford, two things to point out. One, the statute gives special status to American Indian students. And so the students of color that shows up on the printout here includes American Indian students in that category. The way the rule is worded, which it was formerly that Minnesota used to have a state board of education, and they adopted the rule that essentially controls our integration program and who has to participate and who doesn't. And that rule refers to protected students, which essentially is students of color, except that American Indian students can choose whether a district can choose whether its American Indian students would count for purposes of the rule or not. So you could have a very high count of American Indian students and not be required by the board of education or by the rule to have an integration plan. That said, the way the rule works, the rule is essentially a relative rule, and it says that you need to file a plan if your concentration of protected students, of students of color, is more than 20% greater than any of your neighboring districts. So, for example, if Deer River were at 33% and were surrounded by districts all at 20%, they would not be required to file a plan because it's a relative measure of that district to the surrounding districts. Whereas, choose another district and say that their concentration was 22%, but their neighboring districts were all at zero, that district would be required to file a plan because it's more than the 20%. So the 20% is a relative measure of your district compared to all the neighboring districts, and it's only in the case when your district exceeds any of the neighboring districts by more than 20% that you're required to file a plan. But I suspect with Deer River, the issue there is not the 20%, but rather the special designation of American Indian students.
Thank you.
Representative Ward?
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, under the statute right now, there seems to be quite a bit of flexibility there. And so, for example, some districts, the governor outlined all-day kindergarten as a priority for funding this year, but we see in the reports that people are submitting to the Department of Education that they're actually using integration funding to pay for all-day kindergarten. I'm wondering if you could enlighten the committee on how is that possible, or where in the statute, where allows for that to take place?
Yeah.
Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, we may let the legislative auditor catch her breath for just a moment, but she's just arrived, and part of what their report focused on was this whole broad list of activities that were allowed, and they certainly pointed out when their study came out how some districts were using it for programs like all-day kindergarten. And part of that gets to the tension that this legislature has debated over the last 6 years about whether or not we're really focused on essentially mixing kids of color with white kids, or whether we're really more focused on achievement gap issues. And I think as long as 6 years ago, after the report came out in this House committee, we had a subcommittee reported that had a number of hearings that lasted for 4 years on this issue. And to my mind, no agreement was really reached, with individual members of this committee having very strong feelings one way or the other about that. But that the report by the legislative auditor did a very nice job of laying out the different uses of funds by school districts, and the lack of the legislature speaking with a clear voice about what they wanted districts to accomplish with this program.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Garofalo?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow, we see there's a difference between Minneapolis and St. Paul, 480 versus 445, some additional discretionary levy authority given to Minneapolis. Could you enlighten myself and the other members of the committee about sort of the legislative history of why that's in place?
Mr. Chair, members, if you go back to the Word document, the pages from the school finance guide on the third page there on that chart of funding over time, you'll see that Minneapolis's funding up through the year 2000 was essentially quite a bit higher than St. Paul's. This funding reflected both, as I said, both the transportation and the within district options as well, and so it was both programmatic and transportation. And the levy originally was set, and this is back in the good old days when we had mills instead of tax capacity, but the levy essentially was set as a rate for the districts as well. So Minneapolis had a mill rate, I forget if it was 2 mills or something, for its levy component of integration revenue, and with a bigger tax base than St. Paul's, and St. Paul's rate got changed later. But essentially what happened is these revenue amounts were developed separately and reflected both transportation and programmatic activities. And when we converted those to a formula, a dollars per pupil amount, That's when we came up with the $480 for Minneapolis and the $445 for St. Paul. And if you look at the front page now at that chart, you can see back in 2001, Minneapolis's funding was, when we converted it to dollars per pupil, was as high as $536 per pupil, and St. Paul's was $446. That year, the legislature reduced the Minneapolis funding down to the St. Paul level. The next year, the compromise that was reached was adding back the levy share of that funding for the Minneapolis district. So you can see on the first page of the Word document labeled School Desegregation and Integration that Minneapolis was at $536 per pupil, went down to $446 in 2002, and then came back up to $446 plus $35 per pupil in 2003, and that's essentially the level that they're at since that period of time. So the reason that they ended up at the same number was the actions of the 2000 legislature, and then the $35 was the levy share that was put back a few years later.
Thank you, Mr. Strom.
And,
Representative Ruffalo.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Strom, on the third page of the handout that you gave out, there's a listing for inter-district desegregation or integration transportation grants, and it references the Choice Is Yours program. And could you maybe just short story format explain to myself and members of the committee the history behind that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there are three other integration revenue programs listed on the third page there, and if you turn to the fourth page, you'll see a chart with the funding for those programs, the Magnet School Operating Grants, the Magnet School Capital Grants, the Magnet School Startup Aid, the Inter-District Integration Transportation, and all other integration programs. And you can see by far and away the largest of those is the Inter-District Integration Transportation. That transportation is often referred to as the Choices Is Yours program funding. And the Choice of Yours Is Yours program was the result of a negotiated settlement regarding a whole variety of parties, including the Minneapolis NAACP, the state, and some other parties. And essentially, the settlement that was reached was one for that was limited in 4 years for duration, but has been continued since, that basically said that the state would provide for additional transportation funding to fund the choices of children who wanted to leave the Minneapolis school district. And those children could choose to attend in another district, and that transportation would be provided to get that child to the additional district. And so a number of children leave the Minneapolis school district currently under this program and attend neighboring school districts such as Hopkins, St. Louis Park, Wayzata. And what this line item, this integration transportation, inter-district integration transportation funding pays for is it pays the provider of the transportation services, which is usually the serving school district, for the transportation costs associated with transporting those children. I don't know if someone from Minneapolis would like to speak to the actual numbers. I think there's a couple thousand students involved in the program. That program, I think 2005 may have been the last year that the 4 years ran. I might have to line up my fiscal years on that. But the settlement agreement was for 4 years. But that program has been continued after the 4 years of the settlement expired and continues to this day.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Grossman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Strom, in that case, that's a choice that the parents and students make of what school they
want
to send?
Part, Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, part of the settlement was a requirement that the Minneapolis School District publicize the choice options for these students, and it's a choice that the parents of these students make. There are limits on how many students can be accepted by neighboring districts, and I think a few of the districts this year have suggested they're not going to be taking additional students this year, but essentially the parent would make a choice as to which district they would like their child to attend.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Strom, if the in the event that the parent chose a non-public school, would this program apply to them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I'm not aware of any non-public transportation as part of this funding.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And then I have one more question. I forgot it. Embarrassing. We're on TV. I'll have to save that question for later. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Seeing no other questions at this time, Representative Downey?
Yeah, Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for coming in late. So, Mr. Strom, you can just defer my question and catch me offline if you already talked about the history here. I'm not real familiar with the long history. When integration revenue was instituted, was the objective an improvement in achievement and student performance, or was there a broader kind of good of society integration objective? Could you give just a brief history on the intention of integration in its original formation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I've been here with the legislature in the education area since 1987, and so I can't speak to what happened prior to that time. But since 1987 forward, for several years, most of the focus was on mixing of students. Essentially, the issues of the achievement gap really weren't prevalent in the late 80s and early 90s. So in my estimation, and others may disagree with me, but in my estimation, nearly all of the early efforts at the integration program were on essentially the mixing of white and non-white students.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, has there been any evolution in that? Is there now an intention that integration revenue would actually address the achievement gap or achievement more broadly?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, yes, there's been quite a bit of evolution in that. And as I said initially, and of course, Minnesota had very, very small numbers of students of color and very small percentages in most school districts, even in the early 80s. And so when the program's funding was started, essentially there were only three school districts in the state where there were issues related to the old State Board of Education rule, and the funding went for those districts. By the time 2000 rolled around, when the state had created the statewide funding system for this, for any district that filed a plan under the new rule, the issue of achievement gap was a very was starting to become a very important issue. And so I'd say by 2000, and certainly during the late 90s, much of the conversation was focused not just on mixing of students, but on issues as to the relative levels of academic success for white and non-white students.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Downey?
Just one quick follow-up, and then it will probably be good to just listen to the auditor's report, and maybe we can come back to this. But so as this kind of as the evolution of intent started to move a little more towards achievement and performance, was there any discussion or was there any period in time where some of this funding was actually linked to the achievement as compared to linked to just the integration? It seems like we're still living with just an integration linkage here as compared to an achievement linkage, and there isn't any real kind of performance-based funding in here. Was there discussion of that or brief history on that discussion if it occurred?
Representative Downey, yes, there's been a great deal of discussion of that, but your assumption is exactly right, that there hasn't been any official change in the legislature's approach, and that's part of why we have a long list that includes all things like other relevant programs. There's really been no meeting of the minds at the legislature about how that program ought to be restructured. And that was part of why the legislature requested the legislative auditor look at the program. And much of what the legislative auditor's good work did was to highlight a lot of these issues and basically give the legislature some structure about how to think about restructuring the program.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative
Downey. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate everyone's indulgence. That was helpful for me to get the history before we go into the report.
Mm-hmm. And that make a great segue, but Mr. Crone, Mr. Strom, we have a discussion of compensatory before we hear from the legislative auditor.
Mr. Chair, if mm-hmm. you don't mind, I think it might make sense for the auditor to speak to integration funding first, and then we can move on to compensatory.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And with that, could we have the legislative auditor come to the table to give testimony? Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and as Ms. Randall sets this computer up, I'm going to give you just a few comments. Ms. Randall was coming in from a presentation out in Scott County, so appreciate her efforts to be here, and I think you will gain some real insights into the integration revenue issues with the presentation. And I think the slides will help because I think it'll really illustrate some of the issues that we present, although I think you already have in front of you the slides on paper, and so it'll help you follow along. Mr. Chairman and members, the Office of the Legislative Auditor periodically is asked to do evaluations of various education programs And I think as we've done that, we've picked up on some themes, and that theme will be, I think, highlighted in Ms. Randall's presentation on integration revenue. But I think it also applies to other programs that we've evaluated as well, particularly the remedial education or compensatory revenue, the issue that you're also going to discuss as well. But I think you could apply this to other things where you, as a legislature, have established a certain program or policy. You, in your deliberations, decide that there's some area of education that needs some special focus or effort on the part of school districts, and so you typically provide them with some extra money, and you create some formula by which you do that. And sometimes you have to pick a proxy kind of variable. For example, for remedial education, you picked free and reduced lunch because you thought that there might be, in schools where there's a concentration of poor children, a greater need for remedial education. So in other areas, like with integration revenue, you pick a different approach. And you have, as Ms. Randall is going to demonstrate, a very complicated formula that does not allow all districts to participate. And that's one of the real policy issues, I think. Why is it that some districts get the aid and others don't? Particularly when you get to the issue of what is this all about? And that's what I think Representative Downey and others of you have been trying to get at. What are we trying to achieve? And is what we're trying to achieve unique to just the districts that are getting the aid? And I think what you're going to hear from us is maybe not. That there are some uses for this money that are allowed. It might be uses that would be helpful in any district. And yet again, not all districts get the aid. So we raised the issue in our presentation and in our report about the question of equity. Why in your choices have you set up a formula that has some districts getting this extra integration revenue but not others? And then we raise the issue that, again, I think you've given a preface to, and that is, once those districts that get the aid have the money, how are they supposed to use it? You undoubtedly had something in mind that was special and different from just giving all school districts general revenue. You had something in particular that you wanted them to accomplish. And yet, as has already been said, the uses that we found are so different, so dispersed, so unfocused, that when we went out to evaluate what are we accomplishing with this special aid, this integration revenue, we saw a lot of good things, frankly, that were being accomplished, but we weren't sure that they were the things you intended to be accomplished. And so I think now that we have the slide presentation ready, I can stop talking and turn it over to Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Could you please state your name for the record?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm an evaluation manager with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Thanks for having us here today to talk about our evaluation on integration revenue. Just a quick caveat, if it hasn't been made clear yet, that we released this report in 2005. And so some of the data in this presentation are going to be a little old, and I'm going to look to Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow in the corner for any corrections, as things may have changed a little bit. I've tried to update some of the numbers, but just wanted to kind of get that out there that it is 5.5, 6 years old. So looking at integration revenue, our kind of overall finding was that the program needs more focus and oversight. Frankly, we found a number of problems with the integration revenue program. The first is that the purpose of the program is not clear, and I think some of the discussion has been to this point. Is this program about racial balance? Is it about academic achievement? Is it about multicultural tolerance? When we went out and spoke to people, there were lots of different ideas about what this program is about, and frankly, there was a lot of desire for clarification among the school districts that were administering this program. We also found, not surprisingly, that the district's use of the money varied, in part because they had different ideas about what the program was for, and in part because of the different needs of the districts. While most of the use of the revenue was reasonable and was for good things, we did find some questionable use of the revenue. And then we also found that the funding formula has some unintended consequences. I'll talk about this more kind of later in the presentation, but in particular, there's kind of a disincentive in some ways in the funding formula for districts to mitigate the segregation issues that perhaps let them to qualify for the revenue. And then there were some gaps in oversight as a result of the funding formula. Some of those have been addressed in 2009 legislation. Let me back up, give a little bit more overview, parlay maybe off of what Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow talked about, and then we'll get into these a little bit more. So just quickly, and I got these numbers from Mr. Crow last week. Thank you very much. In fiscal year 2011, there were 125 school districts that were eligible for integration revenue, and it was about $91 million that went for integration revenue. $64.2 million of that was aid. The remainder, $26.8 million, was through levy. Now, districts are either identified as eligible for the integration revenue program, or they can voluntarily participate. There are three different ways that a district can be identified as eligible to participate in integration revenue. The first one is if they have a racially identifiable school. And a district has a racially identifiable school if one of the schools in the district has a protected student population of 20% or more than the average population for serving those grades within the district. I know that was really garbled, that's really complicated, but basically it's if a school within the district has a protected student population that's 20% more of the protected student population than the average in the district, heavily concentration of protected student population, they qualify for integration revenue. So that's kind of intra-district. You can also qualify on an inter-district basis, in which case you're identified as a racially isolated district. In this case, a district as a whole has a protected student population that's 20 percentage points or more higher than any of its neighboring or adjoining districts. And in that case, both the racially isolated district and the adjoining district are eligible for integration revenue. And then finally, a district can volunteer to participate in the program and work with a racially isolated district if they have not been identified as an adjoining district. I have some graphics here that are from 2005, but at least illustrate the point. Sometimes that helps. So here in the red is St. Paul, which in 2005, 72% of its student population were identified as a protected student. This is more than 20 percentage points different than its neighboring or adjoining districts. You see Roseville with 26%, North St. Paul, Maplewood with 25%, South Washington County, South St. Paul, West St. Paul. In this case, both St. Paul, the racially isolated district, and all of those yellow neighboring adjoining districts qualify for integration revenue. Continuing with the St. Paul example, I've now added some pink districts or purple districts. These are voluntary districts that in 2005 were voluntary districts choosing to participate with St. Paul and the adjoining districts on its integration revenue program. So there you see White Bear Lake, Matamidi, Stillwater, and Invergrove Heights are also collaborating with St. Paul, which is the racially isolated district, working with the adjoining districts there in yellow, and all of these districts are eligible to receive integration revenue. We found that in 2005, and I don't have it up on the slideshow, but I think it's in your handouts, just a map of the state that shows in 2005, districts that participated in the program were pretty much clustered in the Twin Cities area or in southwest Minnesota, although there's a pocket for Duluth, there's a couple pockets around. So that's kind of a big overview in terms of who's participating and how they get involved and how they get the money or qualify for integration revenue. Let me now kind of go back to our findings and talk a little bit more about those. So the first is that there were lots of different ideas about what the purpose of this program is. We spoke with personnel from 20 different school districts that participated in the program and found, frankly, much more than 20 different ideas about what integration revenue program is about. So I'll run through some of them. To increase parent involvement, to provide staff development, to integrate the community. I mean, the point is there's a lot of them. I can run through all of them. You can read them. Reducing class size, closing the achievement gap, respecting and valuing diversity. So there's a real big range of ways that people thought they should be and were using the integration revenue funding. We looked at all the different ideas that were presented to us about the purpose of the program and kind of came up with six broad categories of the purpose of integration revenue program. First is to achieve racial balance and integration. Next is to address the achievement gap. Third is to provide staff development, to increase multicultural awareness, to increase community involvement, and to increase interracial contact. And you can see that these are pretty broad, frankly, and you can really justify almost any type of spending under these six categories of funding. And that, not surprisingly, took us to our next finding, which is that districts do use the money in a variety of ways. For example, in the metro area in particular, districts use the funding to provide inter-district magnet schools, where any student who was attending a school in an integration collaborative, a group of districts working together, could attend one of the magnet schools across district lines, and transportation would be provided. We also saw classroom partnerships. For example, St. Paul School District and I believe Stillwater worked together in a partnership where students from the different districts would get together and do projects and work together on weekends and kind of form an ongoing and sustained and more meaningful relationship. In outstate Minnesota, it's a little harder to kind of do the magnet schools because of the geographic distances. And so they did things more during the summer or after school where, again, they brought students together from the different districts and had them working together in a repeated fashion to develop more meaningful relationships. And a number of school districts provided multicultural festivals and things such as that. We did find some questionable uses of the funding. In particular, some school districts used the funding for U.S. history textbooks and some for English language learner services. Now, certainly these are fine things for a school to spend their money on. The reason why we identified them as questionable, however, is this is, you know, dedicated funding for integration revenue. We viewed his textbooks and ELL services as kind of standing obligations of all school districts. And as Mr. Nobles mentioned, you know, when we were looking at this program, one of the things we often return to is, well, what if you're one of the districts that don't receive the money? You know, do you have these same needs? And then, you know, certainly textbooks and ELL services are things that many other districts also must provide, and they may not qualify for the integration revenue. So again, what's making the use of the funding special since they're getting the funding under certain criteria? Finally, we found that the way the funding is distributed has some unintended consequences. The first is that we found the way the funding is distributed does not reflect districts' different needs, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. And this issue, I think, has largely been solved actually through the 2009 legislation, but I am going to defer to Mr. Strom on that. But when we did the report, we found that the way the funding was distributed resulted in limited oversight of Minneapolis-St. Paul-Duluth and the voluntary districts. And I know that the first three have been addressed. I'm not sure about voluntary districts. And I'm looking at Mr. Strom for guidance.
Mr. Chair, yes, that was the voluntary districts also are required now to have department approval of their plans.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Strom, for that. So we'll focus mostly on that top bullet point then, since in 2009 the legislature addressed the second one. So let's talk about how the funding is allocated. I know this is a complicated table, so I'll walk you through this, and I'm sure Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow also just walked you through similar information. So on the left column, the row labels, you see Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. They're set aside because their funding rates are established in statute, as you were talking about. And then you can see the categories by which a school district might become eligible for integration revenue. If you're an isolated school district, if you're an adjoining school district, if you have a racially identifiable school, or if you're a voluntary district. So first you look on that column and see where you fall. And then you look at that district and say, okay, what proportion of their enrollment are protected students? If it's less than or equal to 15%, you go into the middle column there, and if your protected student enrollment is more than 15%, you go to the far right column in terms of your funding rate. So other than Minneapolis-St. Paul-Duluth, the funding rate really is either $92 per pupil or $129 per pupil, depending on your protected student enrollment, unless you're a voluntary district, in which case you're $92 per pupil, regardless of your protected student enrollment. So it's complicated, but there you have it. I think the important thing, though, is while your funding rate is determined based on your protected student enrollment, the amount of funding you receive is based on the total student enrollment. So this shows the integration revenue for some districts, and this was in 2005, so you know, here's another warning that these numbers have changed. But you can see, for example, St. Paul at the time, based on its student population, got $20 million in integration revenue in 2005. And you can see this goes down to Round Lake, which received $12,000 in integration revenue in 2005. Now, some of the difference in revenue reflects the funding rate. Some of the difference in revenue reflects their student population. So Round Lake is a small district. It's an adjoining district and only received $12,000. Interestingly, Mountain Lake is an isolated district. It's one of those red districts, the racially isolated district, and it received $54,000. So, again, you can see the impact of applying the funding rate to total student enrollment. Now, we think that the way this funding is allocated, however, does not reflect districts' different needs. And for this, again, these are based on 2005 numbers. We looked at Stillwater and Brooklyn Center. Stillwater was a voluntary district working with St. Paul. Brooklyn Center was a racially isolated district. In 2005, 5% of Stillwater's population was a protected student population. And, in that same year, 66% of Brooklyn Center's population were protected students. Because funding is allocated by total student enrollment, Stillwater received close to $1 million in integration revenue in 2005. Brooklyn Center received $250,000. And then if you looked at the funding per protected student, you can see Stillwater received $2,200, basically, per protected student, compared with Brooklyn Center that received $223 per protected student. So, you know, one thing that we kind of wanted to emphasize on this is you're getting the same funding rate for the most part regardless of your responsibility. And again, you can get situations like this, which I think comes back to what you want the purpose of the program to be. So depending on what you think the purpose of the program is, this funding allocation may or may not match up with what you're hoping the program achieves. I'm going to skip over this since this was addressed in 2009. But I'm happy to answer questions about it if anybody wants to talk about it. So just to summarize, the purpose of the program is not clear. Districts use the money in lots of different ways, largely reflecting their interpretation of what the program is about. And again, the funding formula has unintended consequences. We made a number of recommendations. I'll run through them. The first is the biggie, which is that the legislature should clarify the purpose of the program. Not an easy task, we realize, but something that we really heard from everyone we spoke with, a desire for some clarity on what the program is about. We made a recommendation to consider changing the funding formula, and in the report we lay out a couple of different options, perhaps linking the funding to either more directly the purpose of what you decide the purpose of the program is, or to the responsibility that a district may have, or more targeted towards the population that is generating the money. And then the last finding, again, has been addressed regarding oversight gaps, so I won't touch on that one. That's a quick overview of our report, and I feel like I sped through that, so I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. And, do you have any additional testimony?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would just like to say a couple of other things. You know, we think it's important to define more clearly the purpose of this program, not only because I think it would help the administration, but I think it addresses the equity issue, because if you have a discussion in which you try to come to that clarification, you may find that that purpose exists in all districts, or certainly in some districts that aren't now qualifying for the aid. And I think that's why we have pushed this point over and over again. But the other thing I want to say is that for us, this evaluation shows that it's relatively easy, I guess you might say. Ms. Randall may not agree, to go out and do these evaluations, because you gather the data, you do some interviews, and you produce. But then we bring the really difficult part back to you, and that's, let's call it what it is, it's the politics. It's to get you to decide how you are, in fact, going to clarify the purpose. And it's not partisan politics, really. It's the politics about those that get it and those that don't. And so we understand, and it was alluded to earlier, that you've tried really hard, and I know Representative Greiling has been in the forefront of that, attempting to try to take this report, take it seriously, and implement the recommendations. And I don't need to speak to that. She can very well, as she likes, that it just isn't easy. But I think, again, this is a point that we would make on a number of evaluations we've done. And it also applies to the other topic that you may get to, although that report on remedial education, compensatory aid, is even much older than this one. It's about 12 years old, and so it's quite out of date. But I think the principle involved is the same. If you set up a categorical aid and you say in law it has some particular purpose, And I know you want to leave districts some level of flexibility, but if you leave them a lot of flexibility, the amount of flexibility, frankly, that is illustrated in this categorical aid, integration revenue, then, you know, it's very hard for you to ever know whether you've achieved what you're trying to achieve. So we come to you even now, 5 years later, and say, we're not sure, and we're not sure you're sure that you are achieving what you intend to achieve with this categorical program, or frankly, with compensatory aid either. So that's our message, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. We have a couple of members' questions, but Representative Greiling, I saw you raised your hand. Was it in response to that immediately? We can move you to the front of the list. Is that okay?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Randall and Mr. Nobles. I just, it makes me ashamed, actually, that we're sitting here listening to this report again that I've been listening to sitting in these chairs around this table since 2005. And you did your really wonderful report. You did give us some big political issues, and we had task forces. We heard it when Representative Socorro was the chair, and they didn't accomplish anything. I thought when I got to be the chair, we finally would, and we didn't. And so now it's up to Representative Garofalo. But we had task forces. We discussed it, and what I'm really chafing at, what is true, though, is your number one recommendation to say, for goodness sakes, legislators, clarify what this money is for. And I think, if anything, we clouded the matter by what we did in last year's session by saying it's not just for integration, it's also for and for the achievement gap. And there was even a big push to have it be or for the achievement gap. And it's always been my contention that for the achievement gap, we already have the compensatory revenue and the English language learner revenue and the special ed revenue. But I've always been a big proponent of integration revenue actually being for integration. And if it isn't for integration, then I can't justify even having it exist. So I do think to all of us around this table, we do have to clarify what it's for, because with all the funding problems that we have in our state, I'm sure there will be those that say, let's get rid of it. And I think there still is a need for integration in our society. And now we have evidence that it does affect lifetime learnings. It does affect the achievement gap. So it's not that they're unrelated. But I think pure integration for the purpose of integration is a good thing, and I always think housing should be the way we do it. But in the meanwhile, it's yet one more thing for schools. So before Teresa Graham gets up here, in case she's coming to testify, I see her in the audience. I agree it's shameful that we haven't completed this job. I noticed that one thing we tried to do last year was have the core cities turn in a plan and a budget, and I guess I lost track that all we asked them to do is a plan, but I'm thinking they should have to turn in a budget as well. And then for the funding, it was always our intention last year with the task forces to come up with the new funding plan that would be more equitable and then put it into the education finance reform that we called the New Minnesota Miracle to have it be phased in. Because there are funding cliffs. I think if we this year try to just take this one portion of the formula and then change it cold turkey without phasing it in with other ramifications and funding, that we then do a disservice to our cities who have the very largest achievement gap. But on the other hand, I think the formula right now is not fair to the poor rural areas that Representative Ward talks about, or the suburbs. When this started, as Mr. Strom said, there was only integration in the core cities, and no one really needed to make a case for it in the suburbs or the rural areas. But that isn't true anymore. When you cross from St. Paul into my district, you know, you can't tell the difference. And when you go from North Minneapolis to Robbinsdale or Brooklyn Center, I would defy anyone to know, if you didn't have signs, to know exactly where you cross. And so so I think as a matter of equity, we are duty-bound to reform the funding formula But to make sure that we can justify this money, I think we have to clarify the purpose. Thank you for letting me in there with that.
You bet. Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if Ms. Randall or Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow could help to define how does the legislature in this program define a student of color?
Which one you want on that one, Representative Bills?
Whoever can answer it doesn't matter to me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Strom? Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, members, I know that we have it in a footnote here, if I could find it real quickly. Okay, on page 6 of the report, if you all have it in front of you, it's actually not in a footnote. It's right under program eligibility and funding. I'll just read it out loud. It's a protected student is the word, the term, and it says... the desegregation rule defines protected students as students who self-identify or are identified in one or more of the following categories: African or Black Americans, Asian or Pacific Americans, Chicano Latino Americans, or American Indians, Alaskan Natives.
Representative Bills, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so a protected student is a student of color then when you were okay. And then, is there any thought that's been given to how this definition may have changed since the 1980s or based on socioeconomics or...
Ms. Randall?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know when we were doing the evaluation, there was a lot of people spoke to us about what an integrated school looks like. And, you know, this is based on kind of white students and everybody else, and many people we spoke with said, you know, an integrated school is, you know, 20% white students and 20% Hispanic students and 20% African American students, and, you know, kind of much more of a an integrated, you know, not lumping everybody together, not lumping all non-white students together, I should say. Other than that, I'm not sure what's taken place in terms of from the legislative side that discussion, and perhaps others could answer that better.
Representative Bills, any follow-up, or is that it?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I'm looking for some guidance from members of the committee here. It's the chair's intent that we're going to be covering integration and compensatory today, and we're done at 2:15. If we are not done at 2:15, we are coming back tonight. But the chair is in Ways and Means, so we're going to be coming back after Ways and Means. So I'm looking for guidance from the members, but that's what we're going to do. So if you have questions and you're on the comment list, if you are... someone who doesn't want to come back tonight, you're going to want to keep things brief
for all
members of the committee.
Could I just add, in terms of your schedule, that we don't have a lot to say on our report on remedial education, compensatory aid, because it is so old, but you may well have other sources that you want to discuss. But at least if you're trying to block in a presentation from us, we have very little to say on that. A few things.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, probably that's an appeal to not have them come back. Good move. Well, I'll try to be very very quick. Purpose of integration revenue program, Ms. Randall, you said on slide number 8 that these are broad. And I think commonsensically I would tend to agree with you, although I don't think I necessarily agree with you on all of those. So, for instance, racial balance and integration, for me, strikes me that could be pretty easily set up with a quantifiable, universe. You can quantify that, and you can talk about a certain tipping point based on whatever sociological studies that would arrive at, you know, would tell us the district would be at racial balance if X happens, right? Multicultural awareness becomes a little tougher. How do you measure awareness? You know, what's the quantification, you know, for that? So a very quick question, because I don't want us coming back. So quick answer is the office saying here generally that there are sort of protocols that exist across legislation or that ought to exist across legislation that allows us to structure statute so that you don't have quote-unquote broadness. You get what I'm
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, I'll take a stab at it, okay. And I'll go quick. What we were saying is that there are so many different ideas, yep, that fit into the purpose that you end up with a collection that, taken as a whole, is broad, So I don't know that we were saying each specific thing is broad, okay. But that the net is so wide, you end up with kind of almost anything being justified.
Mr. Chair, I think that's right as well, based on the other hearings. And it's interesting, Mr. Chair, when we asked the architects of the current rule, their answer to that is, yeah, you know, we wanted it to be broad. And I think part of that was what Mr. Noble responded for shared earlier, that there's going to be this balance as legislators between flexibility on the one hand and a pursuit of a public policy intent as, you know, established in this body. And I would submit that this cuts across not just here but everywhere. I mean, we last week we were talking about struggling between local control versus being very directive here. And so here's one example of how that perhaps tipped too much in terms of local control, which is another way of saying, I think, flexibility. My second question is, what we haven't talked about here is what responsibility and to what degree, what we haven't spoken about here is the responsibility of the Department of Education historically relative to all this. Because quite frankly, my approach to legislating is that I carve out broad parameters here. I establish intent, and then we have a government, you know, in the executive branch that carries that out, and I expect them to tell me and report back to me. So how are we doing, you know, relative to your legislative intent? What, you know, measure, you know, the outcomes, the results, et cetera. But my recollection is that we asked that in statute of the department at the onset of this recent rule, and my recollection is that we have not received, or we've barely received, any kind of direction from the department. And so my question is that true? What role should a department play in terms of making sense of all this, and what has been the track record of that since the advent of this latest rule?
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani. When we first issued the report in 2005, we had a number of findings regarding the department as well, and that they weren't kind of adequately reviewing, fulfilling their responsibility, kind of as you outlined it. Since then, they have taken a number of our recommendations. They've set out criteria for budgets. They've put together best practices, and so they responded to our report and did a number of initiatives. The other thing I'll just point out is in February of 2011, they issued a report to the legislature. I don't know if you've seen this yet, regarding districts' use of and need for integration revenue, and it sounds like it's their first of what they anticipate to be many, kind of reporting back on some of those things. So I just found this on Friday when I found out I was going to be testifying here. So it has some good information, and so I think they're stepping up a little, I would say. The other thing I would say is that they've had incredible staff turnover since I did the report 5 years ago, 6 years ago. I think there's been at least two, if not three, people in the role there. It's a very small staff, and it's the number of districts and budget has grown. My guess is that that has made things more difficult.
Mr. Chairman, could I just add a response to that? Because I think Representative Mariani raised the point about broadness. And as Ms. Randall said, you know, the broadness comes from many different uses of the money. But some of those uses individually could get you, I think, Representative Mariani, if you allow them in the mix, to again raise the question of why isn't that aid available all around the state. For example, if you want to achieve multicultural awareness and tolerance, that may be something you want to achieve in War Road as well as in St. Paul or Minneapolis. I mean, because we may say, well, it's not just awareness and sensitivity in the daily activities of that student in St. Paul or Minneapolis or wherever, where there are maybe a greater diversity of cultures and races, but maybe that student from War Road is going to come down and live in a multicultural environment. And as education policymakers, you want that curriculum to in some way, and it would undoubtedly be different in War Road than it would be in St. Paul, but you still want them to incorporate that as a goal and as a part of a program in every school district. And I apologize if I'm picking on War Road, but it's just to illustrate that you always come upon this question. If the purposes are going to be broad, then why doesn't everyone get the aid? Because you get broad enough, and you're going to have elements in those purposes that are going to fit virtually everywhere, I would say. So But the other point you make is about the role of the department, and this would allow me to say the 2 minutes worth that we have to say on the compensatory aid. And again, we raise the issue of you make a very broad declaration of what that aid is for, and we go out and do the evaluation, and again, we found that it was being used for many purposes. And I'll just read a sentence from our report. For the most part, districts can use remedial funds to provide a wide variety of services that may be directed at specific low-achieving students or at the school as a whole. Services may be academic, such as math, reading instructions, but they also may relate to things such as health, attendance, counseling, and safety programs. So it comes to your question. You may want to have a broad purpose statement in the categorical aid. And what is the role of the department? And we specifically addressed that in our report because what we found is that there are a lot of programs out there claiming to be remedial education. And frankly, according to the evaluations that have been done, many of them are not very successful. So the role of the Department of Education in that case should be to do that kind of literature review, those kinds of evaluations, and really encourage, if not require, that compensatory aid to be used for remedial programs that have some proven effectiveness. So that, I would say, very much is their role. And we had found at the time, again, 12 years ago that we did the evaluation, that they did not do very much.
Representative Marianne.
So, Mr. Chair, so the broader the purpose, the easier the argument, probably the appropriate argument, of making sure that that every district participates because it's a broad purpose. And I think what we have before us is, in fact, kind of a mishmash of stuff. So, you know, we have a history here of two school districts that have been sued, well, one in particular repeatedly, coming out of, you know, all the legislation that came out of 54. And, you know, at one point, you know, quite frankly, it's a little bit of hyperbole, but, you know, one could easily say that Minneapolis and St. Paul were multiracial cities, whereas the rest of the state wasn't. Now I think it's pretty fair to say the entire state is a multiracial state. You know, there are practically almost no communities in which you don't have different races and cultures coexisting in a manner that was not present 10, 20 years ago in the state. And so I think that leads us to another discussion, but that's a later discussion, which is, and I think this is what we have struggled with, quite just to put it on the table, quite honestly. How do we meet that new reality across the state without raising the resources to meet the new reality across the state? So in other words, if this comes down to an issue of let's take away the resources from the one or two or three or four cities where we found purpose in 10, 20 years ago, if we're going to take resources away from those districts in order to distribute them across the state to deal with a statewide responsibility, I don't think that's a responsible response. I think the responsible response is with a brand new multiracial reality in every corner of the state, it elevates, it makes it incumbent on us to make sure that we raise the resources to meet those heightened new realities out there. And so, I mean, obviously I'm making an argument, an appeal here, but at the same time, I'm just putting it squarely on the table where the rubber meets the road here in the past, that has been that the only non-creative response we've had to that question is, well, let's just take away from Peter to make sure that Paul and everyone else has. And, you know, that hasn't exactly been, a winning argument. I would hope that whatever we do, because I do think we need change. I absolutely do. This state is a different state than the state when I was first elected in the early 90s to represent. And these issues of interracial realities have to be dealt with in every corner of our state through our K-12 system if we're going to produce effective citizens, you know, for the 21st century. I don't think we can do that based on the existing level of resources that we've allocated up to date and trying to spread those out across the state. And so that's, I'm just putting on the table, that's what we struggle with, quite frankly.
All right. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also noticed with this data that the state average is basically 25%, and that 15% is the point at which you start doing this. So I have some of those same concerns, but we see a great deal of data, but I'm not seeing a great deal of information and data to be able to correlate that to outcome and results. I mean, there's a large investment here, and when we do that, I want to make sure that the state's dollars have some sort of result. So I'm not sure who would have it, but it'd be very nice to have correlation of integration funding to achievement gap, and be able to understand identifiable versus isolated versus adjoining versus voluntary, and then versus the all the districts outside to see if there's something we can learn from this and apportion the money appropriately where it's most effective. And then getting to the data again, I did have a question. I'm trying to understand how Duluth with 17%, which is quite a bit below the average, is receiving a much larger proportion than average participants in this. In fact, Duluth is at, what, 1.5 million with about 10,000 students. Rochester, which has 30% students of color, is at 1.65 million and almost twice as many students. So I think that I agree with Representative Mariano's assessment that this was something that was generated decades past, has evolved somewhat, but I don't think represents what the state is, and I think we really need to look at this because it's not a trivial amount of money. And those students in the school now, they need to have the money and resources put to something that's going to help them instead of, you know, maybe something that's a little bit antiquated and not effective. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the auditors, I know just looking at the outcomes section of your report from 2005 and through your comments, so we don't really have any tangible way to measure outcomes. There's a whole variety of things from multicultural festivals to, you know, programs focused on achievement to focused on integration, and the measurements are all over the board, and the department really didn't do any of that. And so I'm wondering if independent of within the confines of the integration programs, did you do anything to try and correlate other external data, achievement data, or other in and out migrations from districts to see if there's any broader correlation to the presence of integration aid and programs to overall performance metrics? Can we draw any conclusions about the effectiveness of the presence or lack thereof with broader school district measures?
Mr. Randler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, thanks for the question. Well, the first thing I'll do is direct you to page 24, which maybe is the closest to what you're asking for, I think, which is looking at the change in the percentage of protected students in some of the racially isolated school districts and their adjoining school districts between 2000 and 2005. And so these are districts that received the integration revenue funding, and then looking at its impact, if you can even go that far, on looking at the, you know, the integration, the racial balance question or aspect of it. But we did this a little hesitantly, frankly, and with a lot of cautionary words in here saying, you know, there's a lot of factors that affect where people live, you know, and so to think that the presence of integration revenue funding alone could maybe change the demographics of a school, I think is overreaching. But we did look at that because we thought, well, you know, integration revenue, how is it affecting integration? We did not look to see its impact on academic achievement. And in large part, I would say, because, you know, not to be repetitive, but it gets back to what's the purpose of the program, and academic achievement is not necessarily the purpose of the program. Now, that language has become more embedded in the purpose, but again, it's not the only purpose. So that's a long way of saying no.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, is there a negative correlation between the presence of integration aid and student achievement, or the presence or growth of the achievement gap?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, again, we did not, you know, look at it that way. I also think that, as you know better than I, there are a lot of factors that are happening in a school. So whether you're looking at integration revenue or you're looking at QComp or you're looking at the latest education initiative in a school to attribute achievement or things like that to any one initiative, I think starts to be dangerous.
Thank you. Is that it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, one of my questions was answered. Mr. Nobles, you can pick on Ward all you want. The girls won the state title.
I was thinking of that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Ward Road was present.
And then, Ms. Randall, I assume you drew the short straw if you said you were going to be here. But my question actually is, did I hear you say that there is state funding and local levy? Can you give us a percentage breakdown on that, please?
Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom, I believe the breakdown is 70-30.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
70-30? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Thompson, if you could make your way down to the table. Representative Dabney, you get the last question.
It's like having a squirrel for chair. I think I want to start with the observation, Mr. Chair, that we may have the wrong people in front of the committee for some of the questions that are being asked.
Mm-hmm.
That the Institute on Race and Poverty at the university has put out several very well done studies that can correlate integration or racial isolation and academic performance. And they postulate a tipping point after which increasing the percentage of students of color yields lower academic performance. Now, I would argue that that probably has as much to do with the confounding of race and poverty in our state as it does with the color of the skin or the ethnic heritage of the student. And I was particularly struck, the NAEP study, the 2009 NAEP study, found a significant drop in performance between white kids and kids of color. And then if you go through a few more pages, there's another chart that shows the performance drop between kids with parents with college degrees and kids with parents with high school or less. It's exactly the same drop, which I found insightful. I don't know how we control for parents' academic experience, but it does start to get us towards some of the complications and the challenges we face. I'm also struck by something that I just forgot. But, oh, there we go, it came back. I mean, if anything, I think the data on achievement and opportunity and access, because, of course, the purpose of the integration funding was to assure that kids of color got access to equal opportunity. The question about magnet schools, that was the purpose of magnet schools, was bluntly to draw white parents and white kids into places that they might not want to go because of who else was in the building, and to put programs that were enough of a draw that I was willing to step over that hurdle and send my child there. And I think, generally speaking, in Minneapolis, if you look at building-by-building data, the magnet schools do better. My kids attend a magnet school in Minneapolis. That school scores, as a general rule, at or above the state averages on the MCAs. So it, in fact, does better than a lot of the schools elsewhere around the state. But this weekend, there was a story published in the Pioneer Press about the racial isolation, I'll adopt that term, not their term, of gifted and talented programs. And that gifted and talented programs in Minnesota tend to be disproportionately white. Now, that tells me that actually what we need to do is step up our game on integration in order to achieve some of the results that our values take us to. I was sparked a little bit on this by Mr. Noble's comment about a half an hour ago, when he was initially picking on Warroad and talked about the need for kids in Warroad to have the same interracial skills same intercultural skills as a kid in Minneapolis. And you said, well, if that's true, and I think even the presentation this morning in the Reform Committee, what employers want is soft skills as well as hard skills. And so the kids coming out of a district like Minneapolis actually are in a better position to function in the modern workplace than kids coming out of a district with 3 or 4 or 5% kids of color. Because my kids get the intercultural experience every day as soon as they walk in the door. But I keyed on, Mr. Nobles, you said, well, if we want the kid in Warroad to have that intercultural experience too, don't we need them to have the same curriculum? And that's your word, curriculum. And isn't one of the tough nuts to crack on this, and there are a number of them, that this isn't a curriculum we're looking at? That I can't hand a textbook to a kid in Warroad or Byron or wherever and they become culturally competent? That only comes from experience and not from book learning?
Mr. Chairman, I think that was calling from a response from me. And I mean, I think that's an important point. And I think I indicated that, you know, it might take different kinds of approaches in Warroad somewhere else, because as you said, kids going into a Minneapolis school have diversity right there that they have to deal with, that maybe kids in Warroad have a different experience. So you approach it in a different way. But frankly, we found even some of the approaches in the metropolitan area to trying to create, if you want to call it multicultural awareness or tolerance or whatever, I think we're also questionable in terms of their impact. Having a festival of some kind that may last half a day is marked up as how we spent integration revenue to do what? Mm-hmm. It didn't really change the integration or concentration of racial populations. I mean, so I think they're to some degree two separate things. I mean, if this really is about integration, where we bring people of different races and cultures together physically in a building, I mean, that's a much more profound and expensive proposition than whatever Warroad, and I do apologize for picking on them, whatever they choose to do in terms of either a textbook experience, videos, whatever it is, you know, bringing some folks up maybe to put on a cultural event. So, I mean, I guess to some degree we will leave it to them to figure out their approach. I think the task for the legislature now is to decide what it is, what do you want them to achieve? You can maybe leave the flexibility of approach to them, but I think they do, as Ms. Randall said, they even ask us to come back here to St. Paul and say to you, they would like a little more guidance as to what it is you're trying to achieve. And it goes to that question of then ultimately, how are we ever going to get to the data that measures whether or not we're achieving it or not? First, we have to define what it is we're trying to achieve. If it is truly integration, I guess we can go to these schools 5 years later, 10 years later, and do a count of the mix of races and cultures that are there physically in that building. It may be that some people had in mind back in the historical beginnings of this program, and there was overshadowing this certain court cases. Maybe there was, in fact, an initiative to do what you suggest, truly integration. But I think others would have a different interpretation. And certainly I think the law, our evaluation, what you've heard today would indicate that whether it was your intent or not, the purpose has certainly been broadened out greatly from integration per se.
And to, not to add any complexity, Mr. Thompson, if you wanted to come down now, I think you're testifying today, or are you not? Or are you just here to...
Thomas?
Scott Thompson? Or Thomas. Thomas, well, that explains why you didn't come down before. Well, come on down. Just a closing thought on that is just to add some further complexity to the measure, Representative Dabney, and to our testifiers, is that tomorrow we're going to be visiting some schools that, by all metrics we use, are beating the odds. They're doing a great job, and these schools are overwhelmingly ethnic minority. There's not a white kid in the school, and two of the three locations we're visiting, and they're getting fantastic results. So, you know, sometimes we combine data, and it's Sometimes it's situational. So we'll members of the committee, who I hope as many people as possible are going tomorrow to visit the three schools we're at. That kind of adds some complexity to it. But welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. My apologies. The note here says Scott Thompson. So
that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Thomas. I am with the Minnesota School Integration Council, and I also work for the Rosemont Apple Valley-Eagan School District. And I'll try to keep my comments brief and within the scope of this committee. As you may recall, last year, the legislature approved a joint task force to look at integration, the Minnesota DSEG rule and the integration revenue program. That was part of the omnibus bill. That omnibus bill did not pass. And in its place, the Minnesota School Integration Council convened an independent task force. I'll refer to this as a blue ribbon task force. Their names are printed within the final report, which is being distributed at this time. This task force looked at what is really a complex rule, as you are clearly discovering. The Integration Revenue Program is far-reaching, and as I just mentioned, it is very complex. And the task force took the last 5 months to look at not only the history, but the current research involved, current practices, and is advancing these recommendations that you have in your hand. When the task force met, some initial themes became very clear. The first one is that small tweaks were not going to be adequate. That really what they needed to propose were significant big changes. They also realized that integration revenue is having a significant positive impact on communities, not just in the metro area, but across Minnesota. One only needs to look at the increase in parent choice, magnet schools, to see how integration is also used as a tool for school improvement. They also recognize that locally developed plans are essential. Having that local voice and addressing local needs is very important. And then finally, the task force realized that despite the rules deficiencies, amazing things are happening, transformations are happening in schools and school districts, and students are making academic gains. As a result of this current examination, we also heard from the state demographer, Tom Gillespie. We heard from Myra Norfield and the staff at Institute of Race and Poverty. As I had mentioned earlier, we examined the current research on integration and heard from other organizations around the state. We also conducted 5 listening sessions around the state that were very well attended that addressed the pros and cons and strengths and challenges of the current model. We also conducted a statewide survey that we'd sent to various faith-based organizations, businesses, nonprofits, and community groups, which helped give greater focus and clarity to the priorities and needs of integration around the state. What you have before you are basically 5 key areas of recommendations. There are 19 recommendations in total, 5 areas, and I'll just go over those briefly. The first recommendation is to clarify the purpose of the rule. And as you just heard the legislative auditor's report, that is paramount. What the task force recommends is that all schools participate in this program. The report is titled Every Student, Every Day for a reason, for just the reasons that were mentioned, that a student in War Road needs to be adequately prepared to live in a diverse, not only society, but workplace, and be prepared for the future, as does a student in Wayzata or Waseca. Establish and enforce accountability measures. Certainly, we need to know if we are making progress in this area. We also need to recognize that we do have academic gains at stake. It is not just about racial balance, but it is also about ensuring that our achievement gaps, wherever they are, also need to be closed. If I'm in rural Minnesota and our graduation rate is disproportionate, especially for those who may be who may qualify for free reduced price lunch, those students need to have those equitable outcomes as well as students in Minneapolis. Access to opportunities. Intercultural learning, racial balance, and strong communities are all part of the metrics that we talk about in establishing those accountability measures. We would recommend that as all districts participate, they would be confined to one and more of those 5 areas and submit a plan to the Department of Education along with a budget.
Mr. Thomas, just two quick things here. If you could wrap up in the next 2 minutes, because we have two additional testifiers.
Absolutely.
And members, I want to let you know I've been advised that there's a certain somebody's wedding anniversary tonight, so the committee will not be coming back tonight. So
oh. Congratulations.
You'll have to. Yeah, it's not mine.
Now that.
And I thought my jokes were bad. Yeah. So you get about 2 minutes, Mr. Thomas, if you can wrap up.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. The other three recommendations are to identify and support effective practices, seek partnerships and encourage collaboration, and finally, distribute resources to meet outcomes. And that is where the task force is actually convening its final meeting tomorrow to make recommendations on a fiscal model that redistributes equitably the resources across the state while meeting the unique needs of communities across the state. We would certainly like to have these recommendations as part of your planning process to address these concerns, and when a fiscal model is recommended by the task force, bring that to you for your use. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. The next item, next testifier we have is Ms. Graham, and then after that we have Ms. Webb, correct? Okay. So we'll, as soon as Ms. Graham is done, we'll have you be up, and members will probably go a little bit past the 2:15 time today, so... Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Teresa Graham. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker and a licensed school social worker for the last 30 years in the state of Minnesota. I've been here before. I'm going to talk pretty fast because I know you're short on time. For several years now, I've been involved with the legislature in doing research and presenting it to you. I recently, in August, went through every single file, integration revenue file at the Minnesota Department of Education, 133 files, because nobody else was doing it. There had been no one overseeing this program for over a year at the Minnesota Department of Education. Previously, there were two full-time people, Bonda Nwembe and Stacy Collins. They had both left at least a year earlier. So nobody's been minding the store is the first thing.
Well, Ms. Graham, I read the reports, just so you know.
Pardon?
I called the Department of Education and had them actually print up the copies of those reports and send them to me. That's how I found some other items I've highlighted previously. Just so there is somebody minding the store.
Thank you. But I'm talking about the people who were assigned.
Okay.
I believe that the legislative auditor indicated this turnover. The people who were assigned to do this specific work that I was doing pro bono.
Very good. Thank you.
Anyway, I prepared a written report. You all have it. I emailed it to you in September and again in December, so both the former and the new members of the committee have it. It's 30 pages long with all of the school districts and how they're spending the money in fiscal year 2010 and fiscal year 2011. 2 years ago, I gave you a similar report for 2009, 2010, and 2008, 2009. The situation is really all over the map. The money is being used to patch holes in school districts' budgets. I think that a lot of you folks know that. It's supposed to be for integration revenue. There was a lot of discussion about that today. The honest thing I think to do would be to repeal this law that was passed 10 years ago, which, because the funds are being misused and abused, it's over $100 million. And to start over, nobody believes more in integration than I do, and I've devoted my life to it. It's kind of a slap in the face to children of color to use this money simply to patch budgets because of the economic woes of the state of Minnesota. I hope you'll all look at how the money is being spent. There really is no oversight. There's no outcomes, no evaluation required. And really, there is nobody who is asking the hard questions at the Department of Education about how does this impact integration. Scott Thomas just talked about another task force. I've been on numerous task forces for the last several years, and there's never been any action. So please, please have the courage to take some action for the children of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Appreciate your testimony. Finally, we have Ms. Webb, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Beth Webb, and I serve as the coordinator of equity and integration for the Cottonwood River Integration Collaborative, which is a collaborative in rural Minnesota. I feel that it's important to discuss the cities, but oftentimes rural Minnesota tends to be overlooked. Since its beginning in 2002, CRIC has continually worked towards equity and excellence in education. While we just heard that there may be some collaboratives or districts who do or are misusing the funding, I would argue that there are many, many others that are doing things that are very beneficial. While it is important to note the positive impact integration revenue has made within the six districts I work with to date, it is also important to discuss plans to continue striving towards equity and excellence now and in the future. And I will summarize briefly what I was going to share due to the time constraints. Over the past years, throughout the changes of the integration statute, the collaborative that I work with has worked to work towards those changes and provide quality programming. For example, we used to provide diversity days, which, as the auditors referred to, were those one-shot deals, primarily because in our collaborative, the two furthest districts are 60 miles apart. When the collaborative was formed, there was no such technology such as Skype or other ways to achieve bridging the distance gap. However, there now is. Additionally, we used to do Spanish programming. However, that is being phased out. And next year, we will switch to multicultural literacy, which will address cultural awareness and the academic achievement gap. And we will be utilizing Skype to once again bridge the distance gap. Students will have weekly conversations with each other from across district lines. And we feel that this will not only work to decrease the achievement gap in reading, but also create multicultural awareness. I will say I'm originally from Chicago, and I now live in New Ulm, which is slightly culture shock. I really feel this is important, and it scares me to think that this funding could have potentially go away because I believe we have some real work to do. And if a student from rural Minnesota who does not have the opportunity to interact with students from other cultures were to take a job in, let's say, Chicago or Minneapolis, they may succeed academically based on their skills, but I'm not so sure that they would socially make it. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much. And members of the committee, do you have any questions or comments for the testifiers? Okay. Well, that completes today's agenda. Just two items, and maybe Ms. Peichel and Mr. Solon might want to just run through these so I don't screw them up. Ms. Peichel, do you want to cover the food situation for tomorrow and explain how it's going to work?
Yes. Members, you have two options for lunch tomorrow. You can either bring your own bagged lunch or you can purchase lunch through Jimmy John's, and I'm happy to place those orders for you if you would like to sign up on the clipboard. If you're not able to do so now, it will be sitting outside my desk for the rest of the day.
And Ms. Peichel, will the committee be paying for lunch or will members be responsible for their own?
Well, members will be responsible for their own.
Okay. Yeah, right. You wish, Representative Mariani. And Mr. Solon, do you want to cover the transportation logistics of tomorrow? What time we'll be meeting at and when we're leaving?
Tomorrow the bus leaves from just outside here from the state office building at 10 a.m. And so I would suggest members be there by 9:55 or 9:50 if possible. Thank you.
So members, tomorrow 9:55, the bus will be leaving at 10, wheels up at 10. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, is that the north or the south entrance to the state office building?
Mr. Solon.
The east entrance.
East, outside the Secretary of State's office.
That is correct.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members? And members, we'll take up the compensatory funding formula dialogue at a future date. This committee is adjourned. Thank you.